Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Swami Vivekananda introduced yoga to Chicago in 1893 to great suspicion. Americans feared the dangerous alien practice would corrupt bodies and souls. Today, some 16 million Americans can be found practicing sun salutations and chanting Om. This hour on Point, we center in on the story of yoga in America. You can join the conversation. Do you do yoga? If so, where? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me this hour from Boulder, Colorado, is Stephanie Simon, journalist and co-founder of Feed Magazine. She's practiced yoga for 15 years, and her new book, out today, is The Subtle Body, The Story of Yoga in America. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Stephanie Simon, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
Well, yoga's history in America is longer and much richer than even its most devoted practitioners might realize, and we'll get to all of it this hour. But you begin the book with proof that yoga has assimilated into American culture by telling the story of last year's White House Easter egg roll. What happened?
Well, you know, the First Lady and the President are focused on, and particularly First Lady, is really focused on health and healthy living and staying active. And so as part of the proceedings, they had a bunch of yoga teachers came from all over the country, and they had yoga classes through the day. So starting at dawn into the afternoon, and in bunches of 50 kids, and they were geared towards kids, these teachers would take them through some basic postures. And at the end, there was a tunnel of downward dogs for the kids to crawl through.
And here she is at the 2010 White House Easter egg roll. First Lady Michelle Obama saying that the South Lawn had been transformed into a playground.
We've got football. We've got basketball. Yeah, we've got tennis. We've got yoga. And we have some of the most phenomenal athletes here.
So there's the First Lady. It's come a long way, hasn't it? The story of yoga's transformation from a centuries-old spiritual discipline to a multi-billion-dollar American industry. Tell us where and how America was first introduced to yoga.
Well, really, Americans were first introduced to yoga through books because, you know, starting in the 18th century, the late 18th century, you started getting translations of Sanskrit scriptures by Orientalists, which were often British civil servants who were in India, and in their spare time, they were translating Sanskrit texts. And so, you know, by the middle of the 19th century and early in the 19th century, you had people like Emerson, really his family, reading some of these accounts. Some were travel accounts that mentioned yoga, and then also some of these translations of Sanskrit texts. And he and Thoreau really were the first Americans of any stature to start assimilating the discipline through their writings, obviously.
That's what was so interesting to me. Well, one of many things about your book. Henry David Thoreau, I mean, you call him the first in a lineage of American yogis. How did you come to that conclusion?
Well, I mean, I had known for some time that he had been presented as that by other scholars and other yogis. And it's sort of gratifying to think of him as the first American yogi because he has such an amazing literary reputation as sort of a rebel thinker and idealist in many ways. But I really had to go back and look at his writings and his journals and his letters and kind of make that judgment for myself. And it turns out he was very seriously reading Sanskrit and yoga scriptures. And he really was trying to practice yoga. He was trying to meditate. And his only real obstacle was that he didn't have any Indian teachers because there were so few Eastern Indians here, obviously. There were what were then Native Americans then called Indians. But so he had to really deduce what meditation was through the books. And he did a pretty good job, actually, I think.
In his cabin on the lake in Massachusetts, living deliberately, as you say.
Yes. Walden, some scholars believe, and again, I think credibly, that Walden was really very much motivated by his desire to go out and meditate, essentially, and create the conditions for contemplation.
So when the Swami Vivekananda arrived in the U.S. from India, as we said, at the end of the 19th century, caused a good deal of panic, right? Yoga was, quote, dangerous, an alien practice. This is going to corrupt your body and soul. Give us a sense and understanding of the feelings about yoga at that time.
Well, I mean, I think what you see is this kind of pervasive American ambivalence. So on the one hand, when the Swami came, and just to be a little bit more precise, he really didn't start teaching when he first arrived. It took another year after he arrived before he really started teaching yoga. So it was in 1894. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, you had a number of Americans, often prominent Americans, who were very interested in his teachings, who were up at Greenacre in Elliott, Maine, a spiritual retreat, and started studying with him. And he would go out under the pines in the woods and teach yoga. On the other hand, you had townspeople who were spying on them, kind of, you know, sort of really aghast at this brown Indian man going out into the woods, trailing these, you know, Americans to teach them things. And even though the yoga he was teaching was really a much more meditative, it wasn't hatha yoga. It didn't involve the postures that most people are familiar with. Just the presence of someone teaching yoga, which was by and large considered a heathen religion still, or part of one, you know, was caused consternation among many. So you see the fans and the critics almost in equal number and intensity from the get-go.
And wasn't there concern among some of the early yogis that Americans would, as you say in your book, abuse certain elements of the practice and its philosophy? And so they were highly selective in who they taught yoga to.
Yes, I think they were selective in who they taught to, but also in the case of Vivekananda, very selective in how they taught it and what they taught. He particularly was concerned that people would abuse teachings like hatha yoga and tantra, and those may put much more of a focus on the body and are, you know, to, and also to just back up a little, both yoga and tantra are, there are many different systems with many different metaphysics and philosophies and practices, so it's a little it's a little reductive to say that he didn't teach any tantra because he did kind of incorporate bits. But he was concerned people would see yoga as a way to psychic powers, essentially, or use it only for health and longevity, and he thought that was very misguided.
What is the purpose of yoga, or what initially was it meant to do for someone?
I mean, yoga is a system, a very diverse system, that really is developed for spiritual realization. So to transform your consciousness, you could say, some people say to see God, to apprehend sort of what in Hinduism is often called Brahman, the super consciousness, a transcendental consciousness. It's really, all of the physical practices are intended to help you gain control of first the physical body, and then, and this is in hatha yoga, and then the subtle body, which helps you, again, reach these really amazing and blissful states of consciousness. So really, yoga was crafted and, you know, over hundreds of years as a way to achieve very specific spiritual states.
And so what were the great spurts then that have been experienced through yoga, the great spurts of popularity that yoga has experienced?
In the U.S.?
Yes.
You know, it's funny. I think in some ways it just kind of steadily grew from the moment it arrived here. But you could say there was a spurt. You know, there was a lot of activity actually right around the 20s with the arrival of people like Yogananda and the teachings of someone like Pierre Bernard in New York. And Yogananda was based in California in Los Angeles, but really his teachings really spread far and wide because he published a lot of material. And Pierre Bernard was more centered in New York, but taught many socialites and really prominent folks and intellectuals and artists. And those teachings were a little bit different. Pierre Bernard really taught hatha yoga, and Yogananda taught something he calls kriya yoga. So you get a really good foundation of yoga already in the 20s, and you to the point where you have New Yorker cartoons about it kind of mocking yoga a little bit. I mean, the media around yoga tends to be humorous to the point of derisive, but often trivializing, and from quite early on.
Well, trivialized because you hear things like chocolate yoga and hippie yoga and power yoga and safari retreat yoga. I mean, you know, the list goes on, right?
Right. And those are very recent incarnations. And it is humorous because if you really look at the teachings, the more traditional teachings, there are usually many prohibitions on what you can and can't do, and often it doesn't involve chocolate. So there was another spurt, I would say, at right after World War II. Yoga had, you know, had again been steadily growing in the background, but Indra Devi came, and she kind of took advantage of the hunger for, you know, physical transformation, and there was actually a great hunger for spiritual answers to questions raised by the war, but she really kind of honed in on Americans' sort of new interest in fitness and health, which I think post-war there was prosperity, rationing was over, and she really very successfully packaged a very secular yoga, though she herself was a very devout and spiritual person, that really reduced yoga to the postures and some breathing exercises. And Hollywood starlets took it up, you know, many, many did, including people like Gloria Swanson, Jennifer Jones, Robert Ryan, Gary Cooper. And so you have this a point at which yoga is very much in the media, kind of, much like it is today, where you get those shots of people leaving their yoga studios with their sunglasses on. And so that was another spurt, which was in late 40s and into the 50s.
And then really into the mainstream. I mean, from celebrity yoga, a century after its arrival in the U.S., I mean, you could see it everywhere. Gyms, malls, hospitals, homeless shelters, preschools. I mean, my four-year-old came home one day, breathe, mommy, breathe. You know?
Yes.
They were doing it in his little class. I mean,
yes.
So this is, it's now in the mainstream, yeah?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, again, I think the yoga on the White House lawn really kind of says it all. I mean, you can't really get any more American than that. But, you know, it had to go through numerous permutations. And as everyone remembers, in the 60s, yoga was huge. But it was a yoga that was really tied up in the counterculture and psychedelics. And so in a way, it had to kind of go through yet another evolution to become as mainstream as it is now.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about the rich backstory of yoga in America. Here's American-born guru and meditation master Swami Shankarananda talking about yoga, the mind, and spirituality.
In truth, the essence of yoga is what you do with the mind. It's understanding the mind. So, you know, Bobby used to say, talk to your mind, love your mind, get the grace of your mind. He's saying, think of the mind as unreal and a big inert stone. That's very charming, actually.
My guest today is Stephanie Simon. She's author of The Subtle Body, The Story of Yoga in America. What do you make of that comment from the Swami? Stephanie?
Well, what I noticed first is it sounds like he has a Brooklyn accent.
Right.
You know, it is all about the mind, ultimately. And the mind is a vehicle for seeing and perceiving and having experiences. I mean, the mind mediates our reality, and so to have anything like a spiritual experience, the mind has to be involved. The Yoga Sutras say that, you know, yoga is controlling the fluctuations of the mind, and so, you know, and that obviously is a huge challenge for most people, and some can try for their whole lives and not succeed, but really it is the goal.
In your book, Stephanie, you highlight so many women, from Greta Garbo to Gloria Swanson, who have flocked to yoga in search of everything from weight loss and beauty to controlling the mind, as you speak of, to spiritual enlightenment. Do women make up the bulk of yoga followers today? I mean, what's the demographic that practices yoga in the U.S.?
I mean, I think women dominate somewhat, but many, many men do practice. And I think one of the sort of sub-stories of the bigger story of yoga's history here is that part of the reason why yoga has been either considered outré and problematic or kind of a frivolous pursuit is because women have tended to dominate its ranks of followers, although you'll notice that most of the teachers are actually men. Until more recently, with a lot of hatha yoga teachers are obviously women. So, and I think part of that has to do with who has leisure, who has time, and part of that has to do with, I suppose, women's propensity to improve themselves. But that has changed. I think you see at different periods men sort of being more prominently associated with yoga. So in the 40s, late 30s and early 40s, Aldous Huxley and Christopher Isherwood were two, you know, British intellectuals who were based in Los Angeles and Hollywood, and they became very involved with yoga through the Vedanta Society in Hollywood. And then you see that again a little bit later in the yoga resurgence of the early 90s, where yoga got really tough and physically demanding. A lot of men started testifying to the fact that not only were they doing yoga, but it was really, you know, whipping their tushes.
You got a good workout is what they were saying. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
There are calls lining up down the street here, Stephanie, for you. Let me get one in here from Burlington, Vermont. Harry's on the line. Hi, Harry. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it. Uh-huh. Couple things. It's kind of funny because my fiance Sophie, she owns a yoga studio, Bow Down Yoga, here in Burlington, Vermont. And my last name is Bliss, and she's not taking my last name. I just think it's funny because it just doesn't, you know. Anyway, in any event, I'm calling because of this. I feel as though technology, with the advent of the iPad and all of the technology that's out there today, the media, it's essential now. It's almost like I feel as though people in this country, especially in this country, are having a visceral response to yoga and meditation. And I think, yes, it's a billion-dollar industry, but it's also a practice. It's a discipline. And I think that, can you speak a little bit to the technology that's happening now and how that is connected to yoga and why people, do you think, are gravitating towards practices like Jiva Mukti, which is, you know, a more philosophical look at yoga as opposed to it just being a workout?
Mary, thanks.
That's a great question, and partly because my career actually spans the advent of the web in the mid-90s, and that's actually when I started practicing yoga. So at the beginning, I saw a bit of tension between those two worlds and the internet, you know, sort of people being suspicious of yoga and vice versa. I think now we really live through the screen. So I think fundamentally there is a desire, first and most basically, to move. And so that is the asana practice. But, you know, I think that most generations come to a point where they start to question basic assumptions about the nature of life and what it all means. And technology makes yoga and yoga teachings actually far more available. I mean, from streaming a lead class or a teaching by a famous guru on iTunes or on the web to actually, you know, now you can read these books that I was referring to in early chapters that were translations of Sanskrit scriptures from the 18th century. So in some ways, it just all of these teachings become so much more accessible. I do think every generation seems to get to a point where they're seeking, and yoga now is so available, and that's really the big difference. In earlier generations, you'd have to look a little harder to find it. Now it's kind of right there in most cities, in most major towns even, and of course on the web.
You mentioned, Stephanie, some of the early quite dedicated and charismatic advocates, some unexpected in your book, Henry David Thoreau, Ralph Waldo Emerson. Talk to us about the eldest daughter of a U.S. president who received a lot of attention for her yoga practice, Margaret Woodrow Wilson.
Yes, Margaret's an interesting case because she was a real trailblazer in a way. She obviously was incredibly famous for no fault of her own, being the daughter of a president and as a young woman. And she had a life dedicated to reform work and to singing, although those sort of careers foundered. But early on, she was seeking, and she became friends with a theosophist and slowly worked her way towards yoga. And eventually, in the 30s, started studying the teachings of Swami Aurobindo, who was based in Pondicherry, India. And she became so dedicated to his teachings, and he taught something called integral yoga, which really draws on a lot of really deeply Western philosophy as well as yoga philosophy. And by the time she really met his teachings, it was really focused on a more meditative practice and kind of an opening and surrender to a divine principle. But it did posit you could turn yourself into a superconscious being. But most of the practice was meditation. She became so interested and attached to the teachings and so eager to meet Aurobindo that she, in 1938, left America for India, and she never came back. She actually died in the ashram in 1944 during World War II.
Such an interesting story. Here's Janine from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Janine. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I found this interesting mainly also because I took a course in 19th century American poetry and learned a lot about transcendentalism through that. But as a youngster, I mean, I have a performing arts background, and my father had books around. He was not an athletic man, but he was interested in yoga because it was sort of passive and easy, and at least from his perspective. And I took to these books and started teaching myself because I also had modern dance teachers who had directed me on how to move my body properly and not hurt myself. So it kind of worked. And this was in, this would have been in the early 80s. And then in the late 80s, when I was in college, I was practicing yoga in my dorm room. And my first serious boyfriend was from the East Coast. And he had a very WASP family, owned property on the Adirondacks. And he used to make fun of me and talk about, okay, dear, you go off and tie yourself into little knots. and it was a very shocking. I grew up in Southern California, I should clarify, and I was going to school in Los Angeles during the age of pretty much Shirley MacLaine. You know, Out on the Limb had just come out, and everybody was into New Age interests and practicing yoga. And, you know, it was such a culture shock to go to the East Coast and find nobody was doing this, or at least they were suspicious of it. And then I've been here now for about 21 years, and everybody is practicing yoga now.
Everybody is.
Everybody.
It's a good point. It made its way from the West Coast to East Coast in many ways, didn't it, Stephanie?
Well, that's a little bit of a misconception, but that's certainly how it feels in our lifetimes. And I'm from Southern California, too. I'm from Los Angeles. So I actually had a slightly parallel experience, but I was the boyfriend thinking that yoga was weird because I had been exposed to all of the stereotypes about yoga in Los Angeles. And so when I migrated east for college, I kind of carried them with me. But yes, I mean, I think yoga kind of stayed alive and the most active in the late 70s and through the 80s in California, because it does have a body culture and it does have a culture that's much more open to spiritual experimentation. And yet, when you really look at the history, it took root much earlier on the East Coast, partly because yoga took root so early in our country's history, and California wasn't very populated then. Mm. And the West Coast was less populated. So, you know, as soon as the Swamis came west, they found followings, but they usually started in the east and moved through to the West Coast.
Here's Vicki in Charlottesville, Virginia. Hi, Vicki. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jay.
Hi.
Thank you for having me.
Sure.
I have an interesting story. I grew up in the 1960s in Kansas City, Missouri. My mother was neither counterculture or had anything to do with psychedelics, but I don't know where she learned the postures, but she used to do yoga. Mm. And I grew up doing yoga. We moved to the East Coast outside of Washington, D.C., and I took classes at the Y during high school. And, of course, now there's classes available everywhere, and I taught my niece at a young age to breathe and do some of the positions. And it's always been a part of our lives in my family.
Vicki, thank you. Yoga is big business. Stephanie Simon, I'm looking at a poll in the Yoga Journal that says spending on yoga classes and products has nearly doubled since 2004, which leads me to the question, you know, Zen can be expensive. can yoga be a spiritual pursuit when people are, you know, buying $100 athletic pants to sweat in, you know?
Yeah, I mean, in a way, one has nothing to do with the other. I mean, Americans create businesses out of just about anything they get their hands on, and that's just part of what we do. But many people go to yoga in raggy sweatpants. So, I mean, that's just sort of at a surface level of culture. And I think the good news there is simply that yoga is really available. As the last caller just said, you know, it was around in the 60s, and by the way, in 1963, there was a 7-Up ad that incorporated yoga to sell the soft drink. So what she's noting is that the kind of secular yoga that Indra Devi popularized in the late 40s and 50s really persisted all the way through. It just didn't get the kind of airtime that the hippie yoga did in the 60s, but it was still there, and it was still being taught in the Ys. So I think now, while yoga is a big business, and you have to be careful to get caught in the tchotchke trap. At the same time, in my mind, it just means that it's more available for people to dip into. And usually if they get a little exposure, those that really are going to be interested in the spiritual practice will gravitate towards those dimensions of it.
Stephanie Simon, hold for a moment. I'd like to bring another voice into the conversation. Joining me now in the studio is Barbara Baina. She owns the Yoga Studio in Brookline, Massachusetts. She's taught yoga in Boston since 1980, and she's a contributing writer to Yoga Journal. Barbara, thanks for being with us. Nice to have you.
My pleasure.
So who in America was doing yoga when you came on the scene in 1980?
Well, when I came to the Boston area, having practiced yoga in Europe for nearly a decade, and when I came to this area, I would say the most influential teacher was B.K.S. Iyengar, who was, and still is, a brilliant Hatha yoga teacher, and who Stephanie mentions in her book. And I found that for a while anyway, I found that a very satisfying and inspiring practice.
Was it different from what you had seen in Europe?
Not at all. I had started with that. And in fact, I think that even though I was living in Europe because I was a child of the counterculture myself, but I wasn't drawn to yoga. I started practicing yoga because I had a backache. Mm-hmm. And I only took yoga because it was the only exercise offered where I at the Adult Education Center. And I found that I immediately, there was something more. It did fix my back, but it offered more. And I actually think that it's a brilliant stroke that the Hatha yogis, and we need to remember that Hatha yoga is one of the limbs of yoga. It's a very important part of learning yoga.
So all those years ago, from when you were doing yoga, when mm-hmm. you had a bad back, and now you own your own studio, you're teaching, you actually have an empire yourself, a huge following with DVDs and master classes. How does the yoga you teach and proliferate fit in with the big picture of what's going on with yoga in America right now?
Well, first of all, I hardly have an empire, and I gave
oh,
up my.
Oh, don't be modest now.
No, well, I gave up my physical studio 5 years ago, and I'm very happy with that. But I think that as Stephanie mentions in her book about there being a sort of a self-destruction and a period in the 70s and 80s where yoga sort of faded away, and I, as someone who was there, I didn't find that to be the case at all. I think what faded away was the counterculture, that a drug or a laying on of hands could bring this bliss in a jar, as I call it. But the Hatha yogis, Indra Devi and Richard Hittleman and B.K.S. Iyengar, their teachings, I think, have sustained yoga. And I have never seen any dip. I've seen a slow and steady rise. And I think that it's perfect for Americans because, as Stephanie said, post-World War II, people started to take better care of themselves. And so I find that it fits in perfectly. I think many people begin yoga strictly for the fitness and to stay in shape.
Did you find that, Stephanie Simon, in your reporting, in your research?
Yes, and yes, I think that's absolutely true. I think many, many people find yoga because they either have a physical ailment or they see it as a way to stay fit. And as Barbara says, what I did find was a steady population in the classes through the 70s and 80s. But what I think shifted was the kind of public discourse around yoga. There was, at a certain level, even though the classes were still full, in the sort of public spotlight, Jane Fonda was dominating. And, you know, there was a certain kind of fitness culture that rose that made yoga seem a little bit marginalized at the cultural level. But she's absolutely right that it has a foothold here and it's really never gone away.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about yoga's mass popularity in America today, and you can join the conversation. Barbara Baina is with me. She's taught yoga in Boston for 30 years now at the Studio Yoga in Brookline, Massachusetts. And Stephanie Simon is also with me. Her new book is called The Subtle Body, The Story of Yoga in America. American yoga certainly has produced rock star gurus with lucrative empires over the last few years. Here's Los Angeles guru Shiva Ray's yoga trance dance, a trademarked product.
So with your feet hip distance apart, begin to feel the rhythm shifting you from side to side. Let your whole body respond to this rhythm naturally. From here, we're going to enter into the Kriya, the rhythmic movement. And this is an internal meditation.
Stephanie Simon, what about this notion of a rock star guru yogis?
Well, on the one hand, I think it's kind of inevitable. I mean, you see that from the start. The popular teachers are picked up by media and sort of presented as these, you know, celebrities, essentially. And so I think what's complicated about it isn't the fact that they exist, but when their followings get too really large and when they amass a certain amount of power and become – they essentially – do become a little bit more open to criticism, especially if they abuse their power in any way. And in the late 70s, starting the late 70s and on through the early 90s, you did see a huge amount of disillusionment with the gurus because allegations of misconduct came out and many were verified. So, you know, people become popular and we have an intensely media-rich culture that so you can... You know, really, people get elevated onto this level very quickly if they're successful. And I don't know how you prevent that. But I think where the problems come in is it does make you more vulnerable, and you have to be much more careful and have much more integrity as a teacher to be able to manage that.
Barbara Baena, how do you see it? I mean, I'm reading stories of yoga studios and big gurus who are levying huge fees and trying to institute standardized teaching licenses. I mean, on and on it goes.
No, I agree with Stephanie, and I think that it is inevitable, and in a lot of ways that's also a distraction. I know a lot of these rock star gurus or yoga teachers, and most of them, the ones I know, are actually people who are very devoted to their practice and who sometimes through no fault of their own have been catapulted to these pedestals. And I think that what can potentially happen is what did happen, as Stephanie referred to in the 70s, that sincere people become corrupted, and there is a disillusionment.
Let's go back to the phones to Williamstown, Vermont. Hi, Jane. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to share that 9 years ago I suffered a brain injury, and I didn't really know my right hand from my left hand. My brain was totally unbalanced, and yoga is the only thing that works for me. My occupational therapist suggested that I try yoga to see if that would really help me with the stress, but it had extra benefits, and it actually let my brain rebalance so that I was able to learn my right hand from my left hand again.
I'm curious how often you do it, Jane.
Well, I actually do it now at home every morning, but I do still go to classes at least once a week.
Have you found one particular teacher that is better for you or that has helped you in more ways than, say, another?
Yes. One class I went to was basically, he did a very mild, gentle Kapala yoga class, and he worked with mostly people who had some sort of disability. So there was a woman with MS in my class and a woman with cancer, and so he was very attentive to each person, and I think that was very helpful also.
Jane, thank you. It actually, if I may say for a moment, reminds me of my own experience, Stephanie, where I did yoga about 4 years ago in San Diego with the most amazing teacher. I had not done it before, and she said to me, "You're a natural yogi." I mean, I slept so well that night. I had an extraordinary experience, and then I came back and haven't really been able to replicate that, haven't really been able to find that same experience. I mean, so when I asked about the teachers and is the philosophy or the, you know, the manner of teaching yoga different, I mean, does that vary? Is that important to find somebody with whom you connect?
Oh, absolutely. And that's the kind of, again, the great thing about this moment, although you've had trouble finding one, but there are more teachers now than ever. So there really are more possibilities of finding that teacher. And there's also, I mean, there is a really important role for yoga media. So if your teacher's in San Diego and you can't get there very often, but she or he may have some DVDs or podcasts that you can rely on in their absence.
In your experience, Barbara Baena, teaching in Brookline, Mass. For all these years, what keeps people coming back?
Well, I think that for whatever reason people begin to come to yoga, people who stay with yoga realize that while yoga is at its core a path to self-realization and transcendence. In the everyday, it gives a feeling of physical health and perhaps surprisingly, a sense of emotional hardiness. And what I see more and more is social responsibility.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting. Let me read a couple of pieces from our website. Some listeners here have contributed. Here's Lauren. She says, I began my practice of yoga at the urging of my migraine doctor, and I have found that I am in the best shape of my life. I feel wonderful when I wake up as opposed to creaky. Here's Deb from Facebook who says, I started practicing Bikram yoga years ago as a way to become a better rock climber. Now I rarely climb, but yoga is part of my everyday life. Yoga has made me stronger, more flexible, calmer, balanced. Schools should offer yoga and require yoga for athletes. I'm convinced there would be far fewer injuries. Back to the phones now, Nancy in Blue Mountain Lake, New York. Hi, Nancy. Welcome.
Namaste to you all.
Yeah,
I just wanted to tell you that I've been taking yoga classes since the early 70s in adult ed programs in public schools, church basements, small studios with yoga practitioners in Washington, D.C., and on the shores of Walden Pond in Concord, also at Kropala in the Berkshires. I'm retired now, and I live in the Adirondacks. This summer, we'll be doing yoga on the stage at 10 in the morning of the Indian Lake Movie Theater with teachers who come and donate their proceeds to the theater, which is nonprofit, with Karen and Garrett Church. And I find my yoga practice is a goal and a way to live.
Mm. Nancy, thank you. You know, Siva is an important part of the yoga community, is it not,
yes,
Barbara?
It is.
What is it?
It's selfless service. And I think that what I was referring to a moment ago is something that I have seen that I didn't see in past years was that more and more that as one practices yoga and that yoga schools make a concerted effort to do community outreach of some form or another.
Here's Andrew from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Andrew. Welcome to On Point.
How are you?
Hi, fine. Go ahead.
I'm a yoga sort of a teacher, mostly a student. I've traveled to India to study and sort of learn about it more.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess what I find hard about yoga is telling people that I do it and then trying to dispel what they think that they think that I'm doing.
Because you're a male? Because you're a man, Andrew?
Well, no, more because of, as we said earlier, yoga goes through, you kind of start with the physical side and becomes more of a spiritual practice. So I think that it's hard nowadays to almost define what you're doing by calling it yoga. Hmm. And I would just ask the your speakers to, sort of how do they define yoga to people who ask them about it or to themselves?
Andrew, thanks. Stephanie Simon.
Yoga, in my mind, is a spiritual discipline, but it has many practices, including a very powerful physical practice, which is the Hatha Yoga system. But it's all geared towards spiritual realization. So, again, it's a category buster for Americans because we tend to divorce physicality from spirituality. And I think that's why yoga has caught on here and been so powerful, but also our tendency is to kind of try to put things in one box or another. So right now, the most dominant forms of yoga, if you look around, seem to be purely physical. Although, if you scratch the surface, that's not the case, but that's certainly what it looks like.
Here's Aaron in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Hi, Aaron. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
First, I'd like to say I think we need our own yoga call-in every day because it seems like people have a lot to say. I could talk for hours. I teach out of my home here in Wellesley. And the local mall, the Natick Collection, it's now called, has a Lululemon store, and they're a yoga retailer. And they offer a Sunday morning. They call it Sunday Salutations. And I was teaching there the last four Sundays this month. And it's talk about going mainstream, having, the retail space of the Lululemon store, they roll the racks aside and they turn it into a yoga studio, and it actually works. You can just bring the breath and the awareness and a little bit of spiritual-sounding music, and it becomes a sacred space. But also I wanted to comment on the very beginning of the show talking about Emerson and Thoreau. They were, I guess, not only early yogis, but they were also Unitarians, and I am now attend the Unitarian Universalist Church in Wellesley, And one of the things that I like both about yoga and about the UU faith, as you call it, is that you draw from so many different traditions. So in UU, you're taking from Native American and Jewish and Christian and Islam and Hindu. And in the way I teach yoga, my practice is personal day. I try to make it very personal. So I draw from Iyengar, I draw from Kundalini, I draw from Kripalu, I draw from the Vinyasa flows and so forth. And just take, and so I think that anyone can do this. And anybody who says, like you had this experience where you had this first yoga class that was this epiphany and this wonderful. But a lot of people, they take their first yoga class and they say, "Oh, I didn't like it. I don't like yoga." And I just encourage people to keep trying it, and you're going to find something that resonates with you. Mm. So
that's good, Erin. Thank you. I appreciate it, Stephanie. I'm curious what the chanting of means in yoga.
Well, I mean, it's the most sacred syllable in yoga. So one thing, and I'm not so sure the meaning as much as the effect. And Allen Ginsberg actually illustrated this really powerfully during the Democratic National Convention in 1968, because as many remember, it became this bloody, violent confrontation between young, unarmed demonstrators and the police and National Guardsmen that were, you know, patrolling. And so Ginsberg sat down in Lincoln Park in Chicago on a hot August evening and started chanting Om. And once he got the pronunciation right, which took him a little bit, he started having this really intense experience, and his body started feeling like this electricity flowing through it. And he went into a lotus position, which was usually very hard for him, and he held out his hands and a circle formed around him. And he really felt like after hours of chanting Om that he was breathing in this sort of cosmic consciousness, and he was completely transformed. And he had this really divine experience, and he had divinized his body in this way. And he said it felt like grace.
Mm-hmm. Let's get another couple of calls in here. Bill is in Hamburg, New York. Hi, Bill. Welcome.
Hey, how are you? Thanks a lot.
Sure.
Just wanted to comment quickly. My wife's been a Bikram yoga instructor for about 6 years and aspiring to open her studio. And as doing so, she's kind of brought the whole family into it. And I think the biggest thing people need to take away from yoga as an experience is that they need to do it. I mean, it's simple. Her guru always says, just practice, just teach. But people get too involved with what they're doing it for. And what happens is, you start to elevate. You know, I go for a physical mess, but then all of a sudden you find yourself going into a different direction when you're ready to. So, you know, the big thing about yoga and people, I heard the gentleman in Tennessee, how you explain it. You know, you have to just find out what's the spirit of the yoga for yourself, and it kind of takes away its own life. And, you can't just go once. You know, the first 2-3 times you're like, what am I doing? But once you figure it out, then it's just life-changing. And I think everyone should be involved in, you know, doing these things, because it's going to, you know, promote, you know, healthier country, healthier world.
Bill, thank you. Thank you very much. Stephanie Simon, in the couple minutes we have left here, we've been hearing the praises of yoga shouted throughout this hour. Are there any downsides in any form that you found either from your personal experience or from your research for your book?
Well, with any physical practice, there is the possibility of getting injured. So you do have to be mindful and find instructors that are mindful about how, you know, how they teach and how much you push yourself. And then I do think what we saw, particularly in the late 70s and through the early 90s, is, you know, gurus who did amass a lot of power and then abused it. But again, that's not specific to yoga. I think that's specific to anyone who amasses power, fame, and wealth is, you know, potentially open to temptation and corruption. But as a student, I think you have to be discerning, and really listen to your body and your heart, in a sense, and find the teachers that really resonate with you. And if you feel uncomfortable, that's important.
Barbara Baina, here in Brookline, Massachusetts, you say that yoga can be selfish in some ways.
Yes, I think for all the reasons that Stephanie just brought up. But the very first limb of yoga is that this is a practice of self-realization, and so you need to learn to be kind, honest, don't get greedy. And I think that at the end of the day, mainstream, rock star, all of this stuff, as I said earlier, distraction, as the caller a moment ago said, I think once you start to practice, something happens. I think it's the breath and the effort to be move, the effort to be still, and something just happens that I can't explain.
Stephanie Simon, close us out here by helping us understand the future of yoga in America and abroad. I mean, does it have the staying power, now a multi-billion-dollar industry in this country alone? Does it have the staying power beyond other exercise fads of our time, you know, step aerobics or kickboxing? How do you see it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, what I see is 150 years of assimilation, and every time it even seems to go away on some level, it's really persisting in the background, just waiting to be rediscovered. So I think Americans will be doing yoga for a very long time, and I think it's getting a greater foothold in other places as well.
Barbara Baina?
Yes, I agree, and I think where we are today, we're just walking in the footsteps of yogis who've been doing this for thousands of years.
Well, I think caller Aaron was right. Maybe we need a good daily yoga here. Lots of people had a lot to say. Thanks to all the callers who phoned in, and many thanks to my guests. Barbara Baina has taught yoga for years in Boston from the yoga studio in Brookline. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
And Stephanie Simon joining us from Boulder, Colorado. Her new book just out today is The Subtle Body, The Story of Yoga in America. Good luck with the book, Stephanie, and thanks so much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me, Jane.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Find us on Twitter and on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.